As we begin this portion of our worship today, may I say again how blessed we each are that we are permitted, in fact, honored to gather in the way that we are at this moment. And surely as a part of that, we look forward to next Sunday and the commencement of our gospel meeting. Brother Kerry Duke will be with us Sunday through Wednesday of next week, and we're so delighted he's cleared his calendar. We arranged this some number of times back. I don't remember exactly how long it was, but we're thankful that this particular time is nearly here. Please continue with earnestness to pray about the meeting. Make arrangements and plans to be here and support. Invite others to come. We certainly look forward to all the features and the particulars of such an encouraging time as this. May I also say that don't forget our 2 o'clock service this afternoon, where we'll do our monthly, our April edition of questions and answers, and certainly we always look forward to that as well. For the lesson this morning, you've already noticed that we continue a series of lessons that we began back in January of this year, in which we've set before ourselves the task of at least reflecting on the apostles one by one to learn from that gentleman and appreciate lessons and applications that can be of benefit and blessing to us. You'll notice that today we're going to come to a gentleman named James, but this introductory slide is one that points us in the following direction. You may recall we've already looked at Andrew and Bartholomew, that we learned, of course, was Nathaniel, and we also have seen the characteristics of James, the son of Alphaeus. We come to the fourth of our apostles today, and it'll be none other than James, the son of Zebedee. And in our study of him, clearly there's more things about him we remember in the biblical text. But that doesn't change the fact that our interest will be in certainly trying to identify with the man and appreciate some of that which was involved in his apostleship and seeking to make application of that to us today. I would think then that the first order of business might be to at least identify this James, the son of Zebedee. What do we know about him? This next slide will move us in that direction. And so, as I invite you to look at this one, we'll start exactly that way. You'll notice on that slide that's before you, one more time, I have tried to list each one of the apostles. This next slide will do that by way of this interesting listing. And so all I'll do is invite you to notice that you'll notice the third name listed in many of those lists is James. If you look down the list at the far left, it's Peter, Andrew, and James. If you look at the third listing from Luke, it's Peter, Andrew, and James. If you look also at the fourth listing, it's Peter and James. The point is, there is a James that occurs fairly early in all of those listings. And it's not the one that's highlighted near the bottom. I kept it highlighted just so we'll make the distinction. There was James, the son of Alphaeus, but there was another James, the son of Zebedee. He will be our focus today, and he will be the center of our discussion. Let me revisit that previous slide, and as I do that, we'll then begin our discussion much like this. Again, occurring early in those listings, we find that there was one who was a brother to John. We know quite then a bit about both John and James, and their daddy was a man named Zebedee. We first encounter them fairly early on in the sacred text of Matthew, chapter 4. And in fact, we will turn to that text a little bit later in our lesson today. With that discussion of James already, you begin to ponder a little bit about his family. We know his father's name, again, to be Zebedee. It would appear that his mother's name was Salome. I make that conclusion based on Matthew 27, verse 56, in comparison to Mark 15, verse 40. In one of those listings, there is a listing of the women who were present at the cross. And one of them is described as the mother of James and John, in essence, the wife of Zebedee. But in the other text, all the same women are listed, but one is called Salome. It would appear that Salome was the mother of James and John. To say it that way might be to say this: she appears to have been a rather righteous woman. Whenever she's stated in the biblical text, she appears to be a woman who was very interested in pursuing the Christ, mindful of the messages and doctrine he had taught. Remember, she was there at the cross. In fact, she was there for quite a period of time at the cross. Inasmuch as that statement thus follows, doesn't it remind us that while on the cross, Jesus made a statement? I've asked you to note it in John 19, verses 26 and 27. It is there, of course, that Jesus, speaking, said, "Woman, behold thy son. Son, behold thy mother." You and I can appreciate a number of things perhaps about that, but at the very least, Jesus' mother may well have been related to Salome. Wouldn't it all be out a thing that would be far-fetched in light of at least the statement that Jesus made and the way in which Salome is mentioned in other cases in connection to Mary? I'll kind of leave that for your own personal study. But as I close that particular slide that's before you, we know that Zebedee was a successful fisherman. And therefore, James and John as well would have grown up knowing the fishing business, to have appreciated somewhat about what was involved in it. And we learn, among other things, that Zebedee mended his own nets, again, in Matthew's version. And we highlight that James and John were also involved in that work as well. That's going to turn out to be very useful and also very interesting as you and I continue our discussion, as you'll see on this next slide past those listings. For you see, we quickly learn that not only was James a fisherman, it would appear he was also rather well known in higher circles of community as well. I say that because of that series of events in John the 18th chapter. You might recall that again, Jesus being on trial and the disciples had fled. The apostles were no longer with him. But it is there stated, you might remember, that James ultimately spoke with individuals present and thus admitted Peter into the facility. Apparently thus, Zebedee's family was known to the high priest. They had dealings with, or at least were known to them. That is not something you and I should pass by too quickly. It's entirely possible for an individual to be involved in his or her daily tasks, but to have held themselves in such honesty and reputation that maybe others appreciate their reputation and often might well take advantage of their wisdom and otherwise. It seems like that may have been true as Zebedee's family. I would add to that the following observation. It also would appear from the gospel accounts that Peter's father, whose name was Jonah, and James's father, whose name was Zebedee, they appeared to have worked together in the fishing business. They at least were rather well known to one another, and they were not enemies. I stated that this way on the slide. It would appear that that relationship may well have prompted, surely, the Lord's invitation to all of them to become His apostles. They were all known as hard workers. They were all appreciated to be those who were men of honesty. Peter, of course, was known in some other ways as being aggressive and bold. But all of that encourages us to give some thought to James, at least today in our lesson. When the Lord issued the invitation that I will make you to be fishers of men, James took up the invitation. He left behind the earnestness of that fishing business, and he proceeded then to become that very one who was dedicated to the Lord and that very one who would invest his life in defense of Jesus the Christ. I hope all of us will think rather carefully about that kind of lifelong decision, to leave behind the kind of life one had known and to invest from that point in the words of this one. And remember, James didn't know him very well at that point. And yet, he chose to become his follower and to invest his life in the defense of Jesus the Christ. That kind of decision reminds us about the priority that goes with being a Christian. The priority that comes with Jesus saying, "If you love me, you'll keep my commandments," to borrow the words of John 14:15. I will add all of this. The earnestness that the later writers of the New Testament would present in connection to one's service to Jesus. Wasn't it true that in Luke 14:26, Jesus therefore stated to the one who would love father or mother, children or otherwise more than me, he isn't worthy of me. that never ceases to be a challenging passage in terms of application, does it? To make sure that our investment in Jesus, those who would claim to be His own, would in fact live out that which He would demand of us. Let's continue that study of James. Not only are we impressed by his response to the Lord's invitation, but we quickly learn that James was among the inner circle of the apostles. There are several instances in which Jesus would select from the group of 12, three of them, who would then involve themselves in something nearer to Him. I'll just list the examples. In Matthew 17, verses 1 and following, who was blessed to see the transfiguration? It wasn't all 12 of them. It was only Peter and James and John. That's it. Only those three. Among the list of the apostles, in Mark 13, who was the one that in fact trudged along the pathway leading to the place we would call Gethsemane? It was Peter and James and Andrew and John. There was a fourth one added on that occasion. On another occasion, in Mark 14:33, who was it that was blessed to be a part there of when Jairus' daughter was raised? It was Peter and James and John. Only those three. Finally, in Luke 8, verse 51, yet another example reminding us, and in fact, about the matter of James. He was apparently very close to Jesus. I would point out that if my earlier thoughts true, that his mother and the Lord's mother were sisters, that would have made Jesus at least partly a first cousin to James. But all of that leads us to a note. James is blessed to see some pretty special things. He was welcomed into the Lord's inner circle. He was trusted by Jesus. He was, in fact, honored by the Lord to be present on some very faith-building occasions. You may notice in Mark 3, verse 17, the Lord gave James and John a nickname. Now, we've often been impressed with the names that the Lord gave and how that on occasion God changed the names of various of His servants. Abram's name was changed to Abraham. Sarai's name was changed to Sarah. And when we come to the New Testament, Saul's name was changed to Paul. But all of that reminds us that in Mark 3:17, Jesus called James and John by a nickname. It meant sons of thunder, and the word was Boanerges. That's an interesting name. I wonder what that might signify about James and John. I would ask you to notice, maybe the best we can say is at the bottom of that slide. The text doesn't come out and say what the Lord expressly meant by calling them that name. The ancient word that's Boanerges has to do with having a fiery disposition. Maybe James and John were known as those of fiery disposition. They acted rather impetuously on occasion. They acted with fervor and aggression. Maybe they acted with overwhelming enthusiasm relative to what they were doing. If that be the case, the Lord wished to control that aspect of their character and use it for the productive services of His kingdom. Sons of Boanerges, surely that's an interesting phraseology, isn't it? At the very least, we're going to find that James was a man, and so too is John, who directed themselves in service to the Master and did so, as near as we can tell, with rather notable completeness. As you close that slide that's before you with this matter of identification, let me transition our slide to the next one and draw some lessons from those observations and even add to them. We begin like this. First of all, that word Boanerges and the lesson text that was read earlier brings us to think a little bit about the concept of zeal. May I revisit Luke, the 9th chapter? We encounter James in this context, and as Jackson read it just a moment ago, this is what he read. And when his disciples, James and John, saw this, they said, Lord, wilt thou that we command fire to come down from heaven and consume them, even as Elias did? Now, the circumstances there are very intriguing, aren't they? Those preceding verses have revealed to us the following, that as Jesus went about His task of preaching and teaching, there's mention made of a particular village. If you wish to slide back up to verse number 49, you'll notice it says, "And John answered and said, Master, we saw one casting out devils in thy name, and we forbade him, because he followeth not with us. And Jesus said unto him, Forbid him not. For he that is not against us is for us." And so the first matter we might notice is, here's John on this occasion, James's brother. And John makes the observation, "Jesus, we saw a fella, but he wasn't working along with us. We rebuked him, we forbade him," Jesus said. You'll notice somewhat issuing a gentle rebuke to John. "Don't you forbid him, for those that are not against us are for us." But it is in that context you begin to see somewhat about maybe how that word sons of thunder had a bit of a suggested meaning for them. But if that maybe isn't the high point, look at the next one. Verse number 51. "And it came to pass, when the time was come that he should be received up, he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem, and sent messengers before his face. And they went and entered into a village of the Samaritans to make ready for him. And they did not receive him." Here the point is, we aren't told the name of the village, but it was a village of the Samaritans. And inasmuch as a bit of preparation was sent by way of getting ready, that village didn't receive this preparation. And it's in that context, James and John said, "Lord, should we command fire to come down from heaven and consume that village?" Now I think we can see maybe more closely to the sons of thunder. The aggression, the fiery disposition of James and John, they were ready to ask if they could command fire to come down from heaven and consume anybody, anywhere, anytime in that village. That was not receptive. The Lord's response is very telling. In verse number 55, Jesus turned and rebuked them. "I'm not interested in you commanding fire to come down and consume them. My message is to reach the preciousness of these souls that are lost and present to them the earnestness of the truth and to provide them the message which would be what they need to make it to heaven. I don't want you to command fire to come down from heaven." You may notice in the closing four words of verse 54, mention is made to what Elijah had done in 2 Kings chapter 1. Now the scenario there was different. The circumstances were different. And as you and I studied that back on Sunday morning some number of months back, we learned that that was a circumstance in which maybe fire was exactly in order. But not this time. This village of the Samaritans was a village that the Lord had earnestness to touch and had earnestness to connect with them. The Lord rebuked James and John on this occasion. It might well be that that serves as the lesson you see before you on that slide. What about zeal? We find that James was a man of zeal, but isn't it true that it was sometimes misdirected zeal? It was zeal that was not appropriate in terms of what the moment required. You and I thus also should be appreciative of the appropriateness of appropriate zeal. But misdirected zeal can be rather problematic. It can be, in fact, rather wrong. I've asked you to notice perhaps verses that start like these. In Romans 10, verses 1 and following, as we arrive at that Roman letter, wasn't it true that Paul had something to say about matters touching this subject? And that discussion would bring us to this point. "Brethren, my heart's desire and prayer to God for Israel is that they might be saved. For I bear them record that they have a zeal of God, but not according to knowledge. For they, being ignorant of God's righteousness and going about to establish their own righteousness, have not submitted themselves unto the righteousness of God." You did notice in verse 2 that Paul made reference to the zeal of those mentioned, at least at that time. But was it commended? Was their zeal highlighted and in fact complimented? It was not. It was a zeal, but it was not directed by way of knowledge. It was misdirected zeal. And he was describing the Jews. You would have a hard time not agreeing that they were zealous, they often motivated themselves in light of various sacrifices or washings or other things we encounter in the gospel accounts. But even Jesus reprimanded them more than once that their heart really wasn't in it, and they weren't given to the fullness of that truth. And Paul said the same. They have a zeal of God, but not according to knowledge. The Bible commends zeal, and it does so overwhelmingly. Emotion motivating our service for indeed what Jesus has done for us. Surely we in motivation would desire to love and serve Him. But it is entirely true that that zeal could come to be misdirected, like it was in the case of Romans 10. I've asked you also to notice the example of both Jeroboam and Paul. Who among us would not argue that Jeroboam had some degree of zeal? We read about that in 1 Kings 12. We notice that he motivated the people to serve, to worship. But you and I remember quite well, it was worship that was not at Jerusalem. And he authorized people to serve as priests who themselves God had never authorized. He stepped beyond, you see, the bounds of what the knowledge of God would have allowed. It was zeal, but it was misdirected, and Jeroboam was so often described as the man who made Israel to sin. It was a zeal that motivated ungodliness. The example of Paul is certainly a very different one. What zeal we find in texts like Acts 22:3. It first of all was a zeal, but was not according to knowledge, but later, once he obeyed the gospel, it was a zeal that was motivated by directness and the knowledge of Jesus the Christ. What about your zeal and mine today? Are you enthusiastic for the church and for the Lord, for the Bible and that which relates to it? Oh, I hope that inasmuch as the Bible would encourage that of us, we would never be in a category of going through the motions of attempted service to the Lord. This matter of zeal in the life of James really brings us to yet another observation about his life. Notice what else we can say about his ambition. What is it that James found motivating? What might be said about the ambition? Would you come with me to Matthew chapter 20, and we'll look at verses 20 and following. In that text, again, we encounter James and his brother John, but we also find his mother as a part of this presentation as well. That text reads like this. Again, that's Matthew chapter 20, beginning in verse 20. Then came to him, that him being Jesus, the mother of Zebedee's children, with her sons, worshiping him and desiring a certain thing of him. And he said unto her, What wilt thou? She saith unto him, Grant that these my two sons may sit, the one on thy right hand and the other on thy left in thy kingdom. But Jesus answered and said, Ye know not what ye ask. Are ye able to drink of the cup that I shall drink of, and to be baptized of the baptism that I am baptized with? They say unto him, We are able. And he saith unto them, Ye shall drink indeed of my cup, and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with, but to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but shall be given to them for whom it is prepared of my Father. Now, there's more to be said about that circumstance, because the next verses then notice that this was said in the hearing of the other apostles. And now note this, verse 24. And when the 10 heard it, they were moved with indignation against the two brethren. As you develop some of the thoughts about that, I've started it like this. Here, the mother of James and John, together with James and John, came, and she had a question for Jesus. When she arrived, Jesus said, What would you like? What wilt thou? She then said, I would desire that my two boys, James and John, be permitted to sit on your right and left hand respectively in the kingdom. Inasmuch as she made that request of him, Jesus had a quick reply. You don't know what you're asking. Isn't it true? Sometimes questions can be asked that are more profound and more far-reaching than what might be initially perceived. You don't know what you're asking. And then he quickly said, are you able to be baptized with the baptism I'm baptized with? Are you able to drink of the cup that I shall drink? And the two boys apparently were quick to say, we're able. How little did they understand that when the Lord spoke with a cup, it was the cup of suffering that was to be his not many days hence. And when he spoke about the baptism, it was related to the baptism of challenge and difficulty one more time in suffering that would be his not many days hence. And they said they were able. As you and I will learn later in this very lesson, James did endure much, and so too did John. But as you and I revisit the text before us, it occasioned indignation among the others, and it brought about a matter of discussion on the part of Jesus. Would you now notice verse number 25, how Jesus addressed this indignation? Jesus called them and said unto them, ye know that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them, and they that are great exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. But whosoever will be great among you, let him be your minister. And whosoever will be chief among you, let him be your servant. I strongly suspect that's not what they expected to hear. As the Lord then cautioned them that being great does not involve you specifically exercising lordship over one another. But the one who is the greatest is the one that's the servant. The one that's the greatest is the one, you see, that serves. And that lesson has never ceased to echo strongly in the minds of those that love the Lord. To give of themselves in service to the cause of the Christ. As the Lord made that teaching, would you come near the bottom of that slide and note this? That just as surely as Jesus taught about the occasion of serving, might we remember that Paul and others borrowed that idea and asserted it so strongly in texts like Colossians 3:24. To you and me today, we too, in service to the Master, will be servants. Paul would say in Galatians 5:13, that in love we serve each other. We serve one another. That makes a family of Christians so strong. It makes them so bound together in conviction one to another, as well as they serve one another. These two lessons involving ambition and zeal perhaps bring us to one final one regarding James. And it's the one that you'll see on this next slide. I did choose that you and I would also give thought to the manner in which he died. I commented a moment ago that once James accepted that invitation to be a fisher of men, we do find occasions in which the Lord rebuked him, but we never find anything about him leaving the ministry. Nor do we find matters of which he had slipped aside, but we do come to his death. If you would turn to Acts chapter 12, it's described for us in this language. The 12th chapter of the book of Acts. Now about that time, Herod the king stretched forth his hands to vex certain of the church. And he killed James, the brother of John, with a sword. And because he saw it please the Jews, he proceeded further to take Peter also. Then were the days of unleavened bread. The very first of the apostles to meet his death was James. Now, I'm going to use that way, and you may disagree and say, of course, that Judas had already died, and I wouldn't disagree. But in terms of the faithful apostles, those who had given themselves in earnestness to the Master, James was the first to have met his death as a martyr for the Lord. Now, Stephen had already died, that's true. But among the apostles, James was first. And we read here in the verses that we just noted, it says that Herod took James and killed him with a sword in verse 2. He was put to death. And he was put to death not because he was a criminal, not because he in some way opposed the Roman state, but he was put to death because he was a Christian. And you'll notice Herod saw it pleased the Jews that he did this, and he was ready to thus take and do something similar to Peter. As that chapter develops, we find something very interesting. Peter was not killed on that occasion. You may recall that God miraculously released Peter from prison. I wonder why God chose to let James be killed at that time, but not Peter. That's a question better than what I can answer. Safe to say that God had more work He wanted Peter to do. There was more labor in light of conviction to the truth that he needed to present. Why didn't he preserve James? I don't know that. What we can simply say is God always knows best. But James died. But he died in faith. I hope you and I will die that way too. In wisdom and in complete dedication to the Lord Jesus Christ, for that's all that's going to matter. Once one's eyes close in death, whatever has been done or not done in life is now history, and one will have to give account in judgment for that choice, for those choices. Isn't it true that our desire must be, in the words of Revelation 14:13, blessed are they that die in the Lord. To die in the Lord, that leads to successfulness in terms of life always. Regardless what else might be said about life, one who dies in the Lord lived a successful life. James apparently could thus be described that way. Isn't it rather amazing then to consider texts like Revelation 2:10? To as you and I appreciate that, that crown of life awaits thus the faithful. Be thou faithful unto death, and I'll give thee a crown of life. We revisit the thought of the 12 apostles in the book of Revelation, and we see in them relationships connected to their faithfulness and their devotion to Jesus the Christ. Today, as you and I have looked at James the apostle, this next slide is a slide of conclusion. Would we not agree that the apostles were rather remarkable men? In terms of the movement that they carried on, were being devoted to Jesus. They were foundation pieces, as we read later in 1 Corinthians 12. Today, our focus has been the brother of John, the son of Zebedee, the man we call James. We have seen somewhat of his identity. We appreciated his zeal, occasionally misdirected. We also saw his ambition, maybe motivated by his mother, and that too was not fully appreciated. But we did see in his conviction the way he died. Our study of James has perhaps set before us an example of faithfulness in our day. May you and I live devoted to Jesus. With that said, it's certainly time for an invitation, for it could be that someone in this assembly is not devoted to Him because maybe you've never become a servant of His. Being a servant of His doesn't happen just because one says it's so. It requires belief in the Lord, repentance of sins, confession of His name, and to be baptized for the remission of sins. If today that would be the desire of your heart, how much we would enjoy aiding and encouraging you in the fulfillment of that obedience. If, however, you have been a Christian, but as of today you're not faithful, then why not come back to your first love? To race back to the side of the one who died for you and in whose careful arms he would wish to always care and provide for you. Did Jesus not say, for our appreciation, in texts like Hebrews 13, verses 5 and 6, I'll never leave thee nor forsake thee? Today, if you would wish to repent of sins and make confession of them, we'd be honored to not only have prayer on your behalf, but to encourage and to surround you with arms of acceptance and love. If we could help you today in either of these ways, we would wish to merely do it now and do it at once while together we stand and while we sing.